Hey, all you true crime fans, this is Mike Ferguson.
And this is Mike Morph.
And we'd like to invite you to listen to our podcast, Criminology.
Launched in 2017, we've covered a variety of strange cases from murders to missing persons.
We dive into a variety of cases in both the U.S. and abroad.
Some of the cases are ones you may not have heard of, like the Pocatello babysitter murders or the canal murders.
Other cases we cover are some of the most historic in true crime, like the Tylenol murders and the Lindbergh kidnapping. We also dive into cases that are currently breaking thanks to DNA and forensic genealogy.
Sometimes you'll hear from people connected to the cases, like the interview we did with the brother-in-law of the Golden State Killer, Joseph DeAngelo.
There are 200 episodes of Criminology available to binge on right now, including full seasons covering the Zodiac Killer, the Golden State Killer, and Ted Bundy. And new episodes come out every Saturday night.
Subscribe to Criminology today, wherever you listen to your podcast.
The early morning mist had just begun to dissipate over the hills of Belfast, Northern Ireland, on the 12th of April 2004. Despite schools being closed for the Easter Monday holiday, there was a sense of activity in the otherwise tranquil hills. A group of travellers had established a makeshift home in the remote landscape, marked by forests, fields and lakes. Amidst the desolation, a teenage boy and two young girls traversed the area in their vehicle, searching for their horses. Suddenly, their attention was drawn to something in the near distance. It was Easter Sunday of 2004, and 16-year-old Megan McAlorum had just finished her shift as a waitress at the Glen Owen Inn in West Belfast, Northern Ireland. Having recently graduated from St. Genevieve's High School, Megan was looking forward to starting college in September to pursue childcare studies. Fueled by her love for children, Megan found genuine excitement in embarking on her chosen course. Her waitressing job at the Glen Owen Inn not only provided essential financial support, but also occasionally afforded her a bit extra for socializing with friends when she finished up work. Renowned for both her bubbly personality and reliable work ethic, Megan had left a positive impression on guests and co-workers alike. She possessed a vibrant personality, evident in her ever-changing colour of her hair, the glamour of her makeup, and the stylish clothing that always complemented a pair of high heels. As the second youngest of seven children in the McAlorum family, residing on Glencolan Way in the Lanadoon estate, Megan's warm and welcoming demeanour was a reflection of her upbringing. Megan's parents, Frankie and Margaret, took pride in all of her accomplishments. She had a clear vision for her future, and she understood the importance of hard work in accomplishing her goals. To support her education, she had secured her job as a waitress, ensuring financial stability throughout school and paving the way for her college endeavours. At home, Megan took responsibility for her personal space. She decorated her bedroom, personally selecting and purchasing wallpaper and flooring to alleviate any financial strain on her parents. Whenever the electric bill seemed burdensome, Megan consistently contributed to ease the financial load on her parents. Her mother affectionately remembered her as just a wee flimsy thing, their little princess, who was adored by everyone. Yet Megan's warm nature sometimes led her to place trust in others more readily than perhaps she should have. Growing up against the tumultuous backdrop of Belfast during the Troubles, Megan had a heightened awareness for her own safety. The 1980s and 1990s were a tumultuous period for Belfast, marked by intense political and sectarian conflicts. The struggle primarily involved unionists, advocating for Northern Ireland to remain part of the United Kingdom, and nationalists, aiming for reunification with the Republic of Ireland. Ongoing violence and bombings within the city and further afield created a pervasive sense of insecurity. Belfast during this time featured military checkpoints, armed patrols, and the presence of the British Army soldiers in various areas. The city was divided along religious and political lines, with Catholic and Protestant communities separated by the peace walls. Meghan experienced the ceasefire in 1998 at the age of 10, following the signing of the Good Friday Agreement. While this brought a semblance of peace, Meghan recognised that caution remained paramount. The lesson from her upbringing was clear. Not everyone could be relied upon. Trust should be given cautiously, and a constant awareness of one's surroundings was crucial. After finishing her shift on Easter Sunday in 2004, Meghan strolled over to the Hunting Lodge, a local pub on the nearby Stuartstown Road. There, she reunited with her friends, settling into a cosy booth for some drinks and conversations about the upcoming summer and the changes in their lives as they left high school. The group stayed here until just after midnight, when Meghan and her four friends left together. They waited outside for a shared taxi, but Meghan told her friends that she wasn't coming with them. She had a friend named Paula, who she thought was working the late night shift in a local pizza takeaway. Meghan said that she was going to call in and see her friend Paula before walking home. Meghan's friends weren't too happy with the idea, and they tried to persuade her to join them in the taxi. It was much too late to be wandering around Belfast alone, but Meghan told them that she would be safe. Meghan's four friends hugged her goodbye and climbed into the taxi as Meghan headed west on her own towards the pizza takeaway. The next morning, Frankie and Margaret awoke to begin the day ahead. As they enjoyed a cup of coffee in the kitchen, their son came downstairs and told them that Meghan wasn't in her bedroom. Concerned, Frankie rushed up the stairs and discovered that Meghan's bed hadn't been slept in. A thorough search of the family's home confirmed that Meghan was nowhere to be found. Frankie and Margaret immediately contacted Meghan's friends to inquire if she had spent the night with one of them at their homes, but none of them had seen her. Meghan's friends shared that after leaving the hunting lodge, she had declined a taxi ride, stating her intention to visit her friend Paula at the pizza takeaway. Unfortunately, they had no information on Meghan's whereabouts beyond that point. Attempts to reach Meghan on her mobile phone proved futile, as it had been switched off. Fearing the worst, Frankie and Margaret decided to drive to the Glen Owen Inn, where Meghan had a lunchtime shift. Despite hoping that she had stayed with a friend and that her phone had simply run out of battery, they grew increasingly anxious as lunchtime passed without any sign of Meghan. Realising the gravity of the situation, Frankie and Margaret contacted police to report their daughter missing. Colin Mountain, as it's locally known, is approximately half a mile from the Colin Glen Road in West Belfast. With a commanding view of the city, it lies about 3 miles from the Lenadoon Estate, comprising wooded areas, quarries and lakes. Although relatively desolate and reachable only by foot, it had recently become a makeshift home for some members of the travelling community who had set up camp there. As Meghan's parents reported her missing, 16-year-old Thomas Purcell, accompanied by two young relatives, was driving his van in search of their horses on the mountain. Belonging to the travelling community that had established a presence in the vicinity, they slowly traversed a dirt track near an embankment leading to the forested expanse of Colin Mountain. In the course of their search, something in the near distance grabbed Thomas's attention. Turning to the two younger girls, he remarked, "I think I see a body." Skeptical, the girls initially considered it might be a prank, or perhaps even a discarded mannequin. As they approached, the nature of the unfamiliar object became tragically clear. It was the lifeless body of a young woman. She was partially nude, dressed only in a white t-shirt and a red cardigan. Dark hair matted with dried blood framed her face and neck. It was evident that the young woman was way beyond resuscitation efforts, as rigor mortis had already set in. She had sustained a catastrophic injury to her head that looked as though she had been thrown headfirst out of a high-story building. Thomas and the two girls re-entered the van and drove down to the travelers' camp to report their unsettling find. The police were promptly alerted and arrived swiftly at the scene. Taking immediate action, they secured the crime scene and forensic experts were summoned to initiate their meticulous examination. Upon closer examination at the scene, it was determined that the young woman had been killed further up the embankment, evidenced by a substantial pool of blood. Nearby, a pair of underwear lay beside the bloodstain, and a set of woman's jeans hung on a barbed wire fence. Swiftly piecing together the puzzle, police identified the young woman as 16-year-old Megan McAlorum. Despite the severity of her injuries obscuring her features, Megan was the only missing person in the area. Confirming the grim connection, the clothing found matched what Megan had worn the night before. Once Megan's body had been thoroughly documented and photographed, it was transported for a post-mortem examination. Given the absence of some of her clothing, immediate concerns arose about the possibility of sexual assault, either preceding or following her tragic murder. Over the past year, West Belfast had experienced a series of sexual assaults, creating an ominous backdrop. However, before determining if Megan had suffered a similar fate, an autopsy was imperative. A police source conveyed to the newsletter, "We don't know at this stage whether there was a sexual assault or not, but there is no doubt we are dealing with the murder of a young female." Meanwhile at home, Frankie and Margaret were consumed by anguish when a knock echoed through their front door. Opening it, they were met by two somber police officers who delivered the devastating news. They had found Megan, and she was the victim of a murder. Overwhelmed with grief, the distraught parents sought solace in their faith and found support from the local parish priest, Father John Forsyth, who offered comfort within the confines of their own home. Being a deeply religious family, the police allowed Father John Forsyth to administer Megan her last rites. The city of Belfast was stunned by the shocking murder, an event that stood out in a community accustomed to relatively rare instances of such random violence. While Belfast had long grappled with a history of paramilitary-related violence, incidents of this nature were infrequent, marking the tragedy all the more unsettling. Reflecting on the grim reality, Gerald O'Neill, a Sinn Féin councillor for the area, expressed, "This is the worst type of tragedy that could happen to anyone, but people in the area will rally around the family over the coming difficult days and help support them. This is just a terrible horror that has fallen upon that family. There's just total shock locally that this type of thing can happen." Over at the mortuary within Belfast's hospital, Megan's autopsy was performed. It painted a harrowing picture of her final moments on Earth. She had been sexually assaulted and then beaten to death with a log. Her jaw had been broken twice and her head had been caved in, exposing her brain. She had suffered 54 fractures to the skull, as well as brain damage. The level of trauma suffered by Megan was likened to that of somebody who had fallen from a third or fourth floor or experienced the impact of a high-speed car crash. By this stage, the investigation was already in full swing. Police were keen to retrace Megan's last known movements. Initial findings indicated that she had spent a portion of her evening at the hunting lodge and then left around midnight. While her friends opted for a taxi ride home, Megan expressed her intention to visit another friend working at a nearby pizza takeaway. Surveillance footage at the bar's entrance verified Megan's departure with her friends, capturing her putting on her coat as she left the front door. As Megan ventured into the night, the narrative became less clear for the police. Interviews persisted, and pleas for information echoed within the community. Contact was established with Megan's friend, Paula, who worked at the pizza takeaway. Paula had already left work that night by the time Megan came looking for her. After discovering that Paula wasn't at work that night, Megan disappeared into the night. Subsequent inquiries uncovered that Megan then walked to a nearby chippy and struck up a conversation with a young man. He mentioned that he lived nearby and extended an offer to call her a taxi from his home. Megan, however, declined the gesture and left the chippy alone, once more venturing out into the streets of Belfast on her own. By this stage, it was already well after midnight, and the streets were filled with young people, spilling out of bars and youths drinking. Reports began to surface of Megan walking alone along Shaw's Road, a mere half mile from her family home. It was evident that Megan was close to home and would have arrived in just a few short minutes if she continued along this route. However, a twist emerged from the narrative when an eyewitness, an employee at a bar on Shaw's Road, claimed to have seen Megan climb into a black Volvo S60. The description of Megan climbing into the black Volvo on the night of her disappearance intensified the investigation. As police appealed for more information about the vehicle in question, Frankie and Margaret also pleaded for information about their daughter's murder. In an emotional appeal, Margaret conveyed her disbelief, emphasizing Megan's trusting nature, as she stated. She was so full of love and life. She trusted people too much. Tearfully, Frankie implored the community, stating, "If you know anything, if you have the smallest detail, please, please tell the police." After the appeal, a tribute to Megan unfolded as the family gathered for a vigil. It drew a staggering crowd of approximately 1,500 individuals who came together to express solidarity. The poignant event took place about half a mile from the location where Megan's body had been discovered. Amidst their grief, Frankie and Margaret stood united, flanked by their six other children. During the vigil, Megan's young cousin, Lauren McGovern, recited a touching poem penned by Megan a couple of years earlier. The emotional event continued as 10 of Megan's closest friends took turns sharing anecdotes. One who was overcome with tears expressed, "The world would be a dreary place if I had not known you. I'm glad I did." Community worker Jerry McConville noted the community's desire to vocalize both sorrow and anger. He expressed hope that the family would find strength and solace in the community's unwavering support. McConville also emphasized the event's atmosphere, reflecting the broader sentiments across Ireland, transcending community divisions. Police strongly believed that the key in cracking the case lay within the community. To fortify their pursuit of justice, they strategically positioned checkpoints outside the hunting lodge and meticulously revisited locations Megan may have frequented on the night of her murder. They appealed for information about the black Volvo that Megan was reportedly seen in the night she disappeared. The community responded to the appeal, inundating police with a flurry of phone calls. Many of these phone calls came in from people who were in West Belfast that night. They confirmed not only the existence of the black Volvo, but crucially identified the person behind the wheel. 16-year-old Thomas Purcell, the traveller who had found Megan's body. Thomas Purcell had come from a renowned travelling community with roots in England. He carried a lineage that was steeped in distinction. His grandfather was known as the King of the Gypsies, a title that was passed on through generations. This solidified the Purcell family's esteemed standing, within the transient circles that they navigated. Eventually, the Purcell settled in West Belfast. At just 16 years old, Thomas Purcell had already carved out a reputation as a seasoned delinquent. Days were often lost in the haze of drugs and alcohol, with crime serving as his means to fulfill his desires. His criminal record painted a stark picture, from an arson attack in England costing $250,000 in damages to a property owned by Sir Richard Branson, to convictions for 6 robberies, common assault, shoplifting, motoring offences, and even racial harassment. Just 3 months before Meghan's murder, Thomas Purcell was arrested for robbery. In the early hours of January 21, 2004, he brandished a knife at Mary Rafferty before stealing her handbag and her Peugeot 206. Despite being found in possession of a knife upon arrest, Purcell was inexplicably released without charge. This decision foreshadowed a perilous path that would ultimately intersect with the devastating events surrounding Meghan's murder. This episode is sponsored by Unfold Integral Coaching. Hey, how many things are you doing right now, listening to this podcast? That's one. Are you also driving, cooking, working out, scrolling through social media? And what's on your mind? All those unanswered texts, that looming deadline, that worry about that issue that won't go away. You've got a lot going on. In this crazy world, we all do. And we're losing touch with our natural ability for deep healing rest. That means most of us are living with a dysregulated nervous system that keeps us on edge during the day, wide awake at night, and snapping at the people we love the most. But here's the thing, you have the power to shift your body from fight or flight to rest and digest. And Christina Bonnet Acosta, a Stanford-educated integral coach, wants to teach you how for free. She's offering a no-cost 30-minute coaching session to 50 of 90,000 listeners for the holidays. You'll log out of Zoom feeling deeply relaxed and equipped with 2 proven techniques for finding calm in any chaos. Buddhist teacher Lama Pema Dragpa describes Christina as one of the most caring and insightful people he has ever encountered. And a past client said, "For me, every session with Christina has meant real, long-lasting transformation." So if you're tired of being held hostage by your own nervous system, grab your free session at www.christinabonnet.com. The link will be in the show notes before it goes back to its normal price of €65. You're just 30 minutes away from finding flow in your body, mind, and life. Purcell had entrenched himself within the criminal underworld, utilizing the Irish border as a strategic cloak to elude law enforcement while travelling between the two territories to carry out his crimes. He was a key player in a notorious carjacking ring and collaborated with individuals spanning both sides of the border, specialising in targeting predominantly women victims. The stolen vehicles underwent a swift transformation. Their number plates were swapped before being resold in the north of Ireland. Following the influx of tips identifying Thomas Purcell as the driver of the black Volvo, police apprehended him on the 13th of April. In the confines of the police headquarters, Purcell underwent intense scrutiny during interrogation. When questioned about his whereabouts on the night of Meghan's murder, he presented an alibi. He claimed that he had been in the A&E unit at the Royal Victoria Hospital because of severe chest pains. Verification with the hospital staff initially appeared to corroborate Purcell's alibi, with doctors recalling his presence. He also mentioned that before he left the hospital that night, he had stolen one of their mobile phones. However, the seemingly solid alibi began to unravel, as the doctors claimed that Purcell's stay was brief. He had come in at about 5 a.m, which was much later than what he had told police. By 5 a.m, Meghan was already dead. The police were now aware that Purcell had lied to them when providing his alibi. Seeking collaboration from the locals who had identified Purcell as the driver of the black Volvo, police delved deeper into the community's collective memory, A renewed public appeal for information about the Black Volvo yielded additional eyewitness accounts. Some youth stepped forward, recounting that at about 3:45 a.m, they had been on the streets of West Belfast drinking, when they spotted Purcell and Megan in the Black Volvo. They were aware of Purcell's bad reputation, and when Purcell drew closer to them, one of them hurled a beer bottle into the car window. As it was soon discovered, the Black Volvo wasn't actually Purcell's. It had been stolen. While Purcell remained under police scrutiny, another team of officers located the abandoned car not too far away from where he was staying. A subsequent search uncovered a bottle of beer within the vehicle, aligning with the eyewitness statements. Although the police had amassed substantial information about the Black Volvo, their hopes for additional evidence linking it definitively to Megan's case were dashed during the forensic examination. There was nothing found within the car that could connect it to Megan. However, another lead promptly came in. Upon scrutinising the CCTV footage from Purcell's time at the hospital, a revelation surfaced. He had been captured driving a white van, not the stolen Black Volvo. The implication was clear. At some point during that night, Purcell had switched vehicles. With the mounting evidence pointing towards Purcell, the police secured a search warrant for the white van that Purcell owned. Forensic experts meticulously scoured the vehicle for any trace linking him to Megan's murder. Their findings were damning. Fibers discovered inside matched those from Megan's coat. On the steering wheel and gear knob, traces resembling blood were uncovered. This discovery underwent forensic examination, revealing that the blood indeed belonged to Megan. Police ordered Purcell to provide a DNA sample, and it was tested against the DNA found on Megan's body. It came back as a match. Thomas Purcell was arrested and appeared before Lisburn Magistrates Court on the 17th of April, where he was charged with Megan's murder. When he was asked for his plea, he responded, "Not guilty. I have nothing to do with her death." He was remanded in custody to a young offenders centre and was asked to appear before the court again on the 11th of May via video link. In the wake of the charge, police thanked the community for their cooperation with the investigation. A police source stated, "Detectives are following a very delicate line of inquiry, and they have been helped by many calls from the public during the investigation. There has been obvious outrage in the community, and it seems there has been no hesitation from people to come forward." As the wheels of justice turned, Megan's body was returned to her grieving family. On the 23rd of April, thousands of mourners filled St. Oliver Plunkett's Church in Belfast to partake in a Requiem Mass, a Catholic funeral service offered for the deceased. Megan's casket was escorted into the church, its lid sealed due to the extensive injuries she had endured. Father Martin McGill, presiding over the Mass, reflected on the profound impact of Megan's murder on the tight-knit community. He highlighted the outpouring of condolences in the books, testifying to the widespread influence of Megan's friendly and generous spirit. Addressing the mourners, Father McGill spoke of the desolate stretch of land where Megan's lifeless body was discovered, and emphasised the need to cleanse the site of the malevolence that had tainted it. He said to the mourners, "It was a place of beauty touched by evil. I joined the McAlorm family for a short prayer service at the place. There, we prayed that God would free that place of beauty from the evil which had touched it." Notably, the police officers involved in the investigation attended the service. They were welcomed by the community, something that is an unprecedented gesture in Northern Ireland. The emotional ceremony witnessed Megan's 13-year-old sister, Kirsty, grappling with tears as she recited a poignant poem dedicated to her older sibling. "Megan, what you have suffered I cannot bear. Don't forget my love was always there. You are my sister, my best friend. Do not forget it's not the end. Following the mass, Megan's body was transported to the city cemetery for her final resting place. Belfast's busy Glen Road was brought to a standstill as hundreds of mourners made the march behind Megan's family. The word sister was spelled out in flowers and poignantly displayed in the hearse that carried her body. In the aftermath of Purcell's arrest, a ripple effect of turmoil surged through the Belfast traveller community. Reprisal attacks targeted travellers, compelling many to abandon their homes and seek refuge through applications for homeless status. The atmosphere was fraught with tension, and the once established reputation of the traveller community bore the brunt of the abuse. The reprisal attacks not only disrupted the lives of innocent travellers, but also cast a shadow over the broader community, straining social bonds and intensifying divisions. On the morning of the 25th of April 2006, Thomas Purcell appeared in court in Belfast. Despite maintaining his innocence since the day of his arrest, Purcell stunned the courtroom by reversing course at the 11th hour. In an unexpected turn of events, he instead pleaded guilty to the murder of Megan McAlorm, finally lifting the veil on the gruesome details of the case. The court learned that Megan, walking alone that night, encountered Thomas Purcell in the stolen black Volvo. Whether through an offer of a ride or a forceful abduction, the last reported sighting of Megan occurred around 4 a.m. when a group of youths hurled a beer bottle into the Volvo. A gap in the timeline stretched from that moment until 5:30 a.m., marking the period during which Purcell took Megan's life. Sometime during those 90 minutes, Purcell swapped the Volvo for his own white Peugeot van, which he then used to transport Megan to the isolated spot where he killed her. There was evidence that Megan had sex sometime before her death, although it couldn't be determined if she were raped or it was consensual sex. Based on the evidence at the crime scene, however, it was most likely rape. However, Purcell had told psychologist Dr. Ian Bounds that they had consensual sex. He claimed to the psychologist, "I met the girl, we had sex. I got angry and killed her, that's all." Purcell elaborated, telling the psychologist that after having sex, Megan had looked at him in a sneering way. He said, "She said I was the first gypsy she had sex with. I lost it and beat the fuck out of her." Purcell inflicted such a powerful blow on Megan that it resulted in fractures in two places on her jaw. In the aftermath of the assault, as Megan lay injured on the ground, Purcell seized a log and battered her head and face. Having ended Megan's life, Purcell proceeded to the Royal Victoria Hospital, feigning chest pains with the sole intention of establishing an alibi for the night of the murder. While at the hospital, he took advantage of the situation to steal a doctor's mobile phone and later attempted to sell it to a relative. Following this, Purcell returned to his community of travellers, conveniently located a short distance from where he killed Megan. He then orchestrated an outing with two young girls, under the pretext of searching for horses in the desolate stretch of land where Megan's body had been abandoned. His ulterior motive was to have the girls unwittingly discover Megan's remains, deluding himself into thinking that this would somehow distance him from the murder. Megan's family filled the courtroom, eager to witness Purcell's plea, yet their anticipation was tainted with disappointment. Purcell's admission of guilt wasn't driven by a desire to alleviate the family's grief. Rather, it was a strategic move to secure a more lenient sentence. The family braced themselves for the likelihood of him receiving a sentence at the Secretary of State's pleasure, with a minimum confinement of 3 years and an annual review, culminating in the Secretary of State deciding on his release. Upon release, Purcell could be relocated and potentially granted a new identity if there was deemed to be a risk of reprisal attacks. A friend of the McAlorm family commented, "We were prepared for a lengthy and traumatic trial, and we're relieved we have been spared that. However, we would hope that any sentence would reflect the brutality of his crime and the suffering it has caused. After his court appearance, Purcell was transferred back to Hyde Bank Young Offender Centre, with the sentencing phase looming. However, before reaching this stage, pre-sentencing and psychiatric reports needed to be prepared. In the meantime, Megan's family took proactive measures, leading a protest outside Curly's shopping centre in the west of the city. Their aim was to advocate for a more severe sentence for Purcell, fearing that he might receive leniency. Megan's mother, Margaret, asserted, "Life should mean life. This man needs to be incarcerated for his entire life so that there won't be any more Megans." Margaret went on to describe how the entire family was serving a life sentence due to what had happened to Megan. She stressed that Purcell deserved a similar fate. Defiantly, she declared, "I could be sitting in my house right now, depressed and crying, but I have to do this. He must be kept off the streets." Their efforts gained momentum as the family successfully collected 2,000 signatures for a petition, intending to send it to the Secretary of State, Peter Hain. In the wake of the guilty plea, the travelling community in Belfast received even more backlash. Purcell's actions had brought shame to the community, with one member lamenting, "People are quick to judge travellers and he just made things harder for all of us. It's common knowledge there'll be a handsome reward if someone in prison does the deed and takes him out." Rumours had begun circulating around Belfast that £10,000 was offered to anybody who killed Purcell in Hyde Bank Young Offenders Centre. Before Purcell was sentenced for Megan's murder, he was convicted of the robbery of Megan Rafferty and was sentenced to 3 years in prison. He then returned to court on the 26th of May, for the sentencing phase in Megan's murder. The facts of the case were read aloud, and the prosecution and defence made so many submissions that Mr. Justice McLaughlin said he needed time to consider what minimum tariff the mandatory life sentence should carry. He said that he needed time to examine all of the evidence, and said that he would pass the sentence the following week. Before then, Megan's mother, Margaret, continued gathering signatures to try and ensure Purcell didn't receive a lenient sentence. She revealed that on the night that Megan was killed, she had borrowed a pair of her mother's new boots. When her body was discovered, the boots were missing. Margaret commented, "There is no explanation why he would have removed them, apart from wanting them as some sort of sick souvenir. That's the type of person we're dealing with here. He should spend the rest of his days behind bars." By the 31st of May, the judge had made his decision and everybody was called back to court. The courtroom fell to a hushed silence as Mr. Justice McLaughlin delivered his sentence. He sentenced Thomas Purcell to life in prison with a minimum sentence of just 15 years. He had taken into consideration Purcell's young age and his guilty plea. In handing down the sentence, he said, "Megan was just 16 years old when she died, and she had been a bright, vivacious, fun-loving young woman, a credit to her parents and family, and had everything to live for. She had been brought up by her parents to respect others, to contribute to society, and she had a bright future ahead of her. You destroyed all of that by killing her, and in doing so, destroyed the lives of her parents, brothers and sisters." With time served on remand, the prospect of Purcell being released in just 12 years stirred immense outrage among all of Megan's loved ones. Outside of court, Margaret broke down. She denounced the lenient sentence as a disgrace, expressing her anguish. "He could be free after another 12 and a half years. He will be a young man and able to have a life that he robbed my beautiful innocent daughter of." She said that there was no doubt in her mind that Purcell would reoffend, and said that his sentence wasn't a deterrent to other criminals. The uncertainty surrounding whether Megan was raped or not meant that Purcell was not placed on the sex offenders registry, adding another layer of frustration for her grieving family. Margaret continued and said through tears, "My husband Frankie is a rock, but he is hurting so bad. Megan loved her daddy so much. He says he knows her last words would have been to call for him. He couldn't help her, and that kills him. No one could help her. That monster made sure that no one would hear her screams. Undeterred, Megan's family persisted in their quest for justice, amassing over 40,000 signatures on their petition for stricter sentences. Taking their plea to Westminster, they presented the petition to the Attorney General, Lord Goldsmith, urging for life imprisonment to truly mean life, and requesting that Purcell be referred to the Northern Ireland Court of Appeal for a lengthier sentence. Margaret highlighted the lack of deterrence, and the disheartening reality that, in Northern Ireland, one could commit a heinous crime such as rape and potentially be released in a mere 2.5 years. Despite their plea, the Attorney General rejected the family's request, refusing to refer Purcell to the Northern Ireland Court of Appeal. In a break with protocol, Lord Goldsmith issued a handwritten letter to Megan's family which read, "I will never forget Megan and what you told me yesterday as we continue to review how best to protect decent people from dangerous offenders." In the beginning of 2008, Megan's family were hit with further disappointment when they found out that Purcell had been moved to a jail in England. They criticised the prison service for not informing them of his move, with Megan's brother Richard commenting, "We're just really shocked that the prison service didn't even give us the courtesy to lift the phone." The prison service responded and said it wasn't normal procedure for them to inform the victim's families to avoid causing upset or stress. In the ensuing years, Megan's family tirelessly advocated for an increase in Purcell's sentence, yet their pleas fell on deaf ears. The culmination of their efforts came in January of 2021, when it was announced that Thomas Purcell had been granted parole. He had initially sought parole in May 2019, after serving 15 years, only to be deemed unfit for release at that time. In March of 2021, Thomas Purcell was released on parole. The conditions of his release included a prohibition from entering the area of Belfast, where Megan's family lived and worked, as well as a ban from visiting the cemetery where she rested. Megan's mother, Margaret, had passed away before Purcell's release, succumbing to a rare autoimmune condition that she had battled for decades. Her death had taken place in 2017, while awaiting a liver transplant. Margaret was laid to rest alongside her daughter in City Cemetery. Megan McAlorum once had a promising future ahead of her at the age of 16. She was diligently saving money to embark on her college journey after the upcoming summer. However, in 2004, a fateful night altered the course of her life. Following her separation from friends, Megan encountered Thomas Purcell, a troubled youth with a criminal record. Despite the brutality of Megan's murder, Thomas Purcell is a free man today. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'd like to say a massive thank you to my newest supporters up on Patreon, Dana, Amanda, Ryan, Jess, Vicky, and Terry. If you'd like to join us on Patreon, the link is in the show notes. In exchange for your support up on there, I upload bonus episodes of Morbidology Plus that aren't on the regular podcast platforms. I also upload ad-free and early release episodes, behind the scenes, which includes bonus audio, video, and case files, and I also send out some cool merch, along with a handwritten card. If you'd like to support me in another way, please consider leaving me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you're listening. Ratings and reviews are a super easy way to support a show that you like, and I genuinely do appreciate the feedback. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read some true crime articles. Please stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, British Murders. Until next time, take care of yourselves, Stay safe and have an amazing week.
Did you know that the most prolific serial killer in modern history was born in Britain? Were you aware that nearly 2 murders happen every day in the UK? My name's Stuart Blues, and I'm the host of British Murders, a true crime podcast focusing exclusively on British murder cases and serial killers. Every Thursday, I tell the detailed story of a British murder case within the bite-sized time frame of 15 to 30 minutes. That's British Murders, available to stream on your favourite podcast platform now.